evening, everybody. My name is Harold Fox, and I'm an alcoholic. Truly by the grace of a loving God and a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't had a drink today. For that, I'm very, very grateful. I got to be honest with you, I'm on nerves a little bit this evening. I saw some things happen over near our campsite today that bothered me a lot. And it took me back to some things that happened from my childhood. And I need to let this go, but I guess what I need to know is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys told me that the one thing I needed to know is that there was one word to describe this program, and it was called change. And I just think that's what this whole deal is all about, is change. And I saw some things that just looked like they needed to be changed, and I couldn't fix it, and it bothered me immensely. Maybe I need to go to Al-Anon, Gene. What do you think? I don't know, I don't know. I'd like to thank Marvin and Shirley for inviting me to come over here. I met them on a cruise ship after an international convention a couple of years ago. There was another deal where we just went out and we went on a cruise, and I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I need to suit up and show up, and they slide this little thing underneath your door when you're out on these cruise ships. And my wife and I were talking about what we were going to do, and I wanted to go and experience and do it all. I learned how to play bingo on a cruise ship, But I slid this thing underneath the door, and it's a little agenda of what you're going to do every day. And I get this thing, and I look at it, and it says, "Friends of Bill Bevian, meet in the promenade deck." There was a cocktail lounge just where it was, at the piano bar, which is a great place to have an AA meeting. And I walked in, and Marvin and Shirley were there, and we've become friends. And I've had the opportunity to come over here for the last couple of years and participate in your conference. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love everything that it's afforded me and everything that it's allowed me to do. I get to go and do things today that didn't. For somebody who was just sitting around in a pair of dirty pajamas a little less than 8 years ago in an apartment peeking out of the blinds wondering when they were coming to get me, this is a hell of a deal. This is a good deal for people like me. I'm glad to know today that I have a disease called alcoholism. I didn't know that. I just thought that I was unique and that maybe I was just a little bit different and people didn't quite understand me. And I felt that way from an early, early age, I come from a very, what I would like to consider a pretty normal family and middle class family. I grew up in Long Beach, California. I'm convinced I probably had alcoholism the day I slid down the chute and I needed a drink, they patted me on the fanny and I started whining and not a lot's changed since. And I went to elementary school and I played sports and went through junior high school and I discovered that the girls started to have bumps and I didn't have bumps and we were like 12 years old, and I'll never forget going to those sock hops that they had where the men were on the one side of the gym and the women were on the other side of the gym. They'd play the music and they'd go dance, and I just couldn't quite get across that floor. Just couldn't do it. One night somebody took me out behind that gym and they opened up a bottle of Ripple wine, which I don't even know that it ever got near great, but I got to be honest with you, the effect produced by alcohol in me was absolutely astonishing. And I loved the effect produced by that alcohol. But I was able to go back in that gym and dance, and I found something that was to carry me through the next 30 years of my life. I loved everything that alcohol did for me, but when it got near the end, I didn't like it so much because I got in a lot of trouble. I left Alcoholics Anonymous on the 26th of May, 1990. My second wife had just left me. I was 6 days short of my 44th birthday. My two children from my first marriage wanted nothing to do with me. I had one grandchild I wasn't allowed to visit. My business was going bankrupt. Imagine that, a big shot contractor like me that was going bankrupt. I mean, it certainly couldn't be the alcohol. I just moved back in with my mother, which I guess is where a lot of 44-year-old alcoholic males end up if their mom's still alive. And I knew my life was unmanageable. Absolutely knew my life was unmanageable, but I didn't understand anything about being powerless over alcohol. I didn't know anything about a phenomena craving. I didn't understand about a physical allergy or an obsession of the mind or a spiritual malady. That stuff was all Greek to me until I got to you guys. So I went on through junior high school, and I went to high school, and I played sports there. I played on the golf team, which was probably the greatest thing for a little budding alcoholic to do, because after fourth period, I had fifth period lunch and sixth period PE, and we went out to the golf course, and we put a half pint in our golf bags, and geez, it just seemed like I played wonderful golf when I would drink whiskey. I went to college. Was supposed to be kind of a predestined thing, and I was a political science major. My father was a labor leader. I was going to follow in his footsteps, and I did college. I did a lot of things kind of in reverse. I don't know about anybody else or if anybody can identify with that, but I started at the university level, and then I went to the junior college level, and then I went to trade school, which is, I don't know, it's not exactly the way I think we're supposed to do things, but that's the path I chose to lead. And I was a fraternity boy when I got in college. We were drinking out of beer bongs long before the kids that do it today were doing it. And I don't know, life was good, you know. And I met her, and we got married, and we set out to trudge the road to happy destiny. I was married to my first wife for 3 weeks short of 20 years, and we had two beautiful daughters. We lived in Cerritos, California. And life was pretty good, you know, and I was pretty successful. You know, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me that I needed to read Bill's story. And they told me that I needed to try to identify with Bill. And I picked it up and I read the first page. And he was old and he was a stockbroker, and I was middle-aged and was a sheet metal worker, and I put it away. And so that doesn't have a thing to do with me. And somebody took me aside. Thank God for the people like Walt and Bill and somebody that have been around here for a long time. They came here before me and said, well, you need to know that you have a disease called alcoholism, and you need to read in Bill's story again and try to identify with where you think like Bill thinks and where you feel like Bill feels and where you drank like Bill drank. And so I was to pick the book up again, and I started to read the book. And you know, Bill talks in there about the drive for success was on, that I proved to the world that I was important. And that, man, that's what I wanted to be. It was important. I wanted to be somebody. And he got very, very successful after he came back from the war as a stock speculator, and he made a lot of money. And a little later in the story it says, I had arrived. And boy, that's what I did. I arrived, and I did really, really well. And I went on for 20 years, and then my wife walked into the house one day, and she says, into my office, and she says, I want a divorce. This is in 1986, and I was devastated, absolutely devastated when she walked in and she told me that. I said, well, don't you want to grow old together? And she goes, and I go, don't you want to have a husband for your, you know, and a father for your children? She goes, it's not that I don't love you. I can't stand to watch you kill yourself anymore. And you know, I drank for 4 more years after that. I continued to drink. And so I got in and out of the house, and I was doing this in-the-house thing, out-of-the-house thing, and my behavior got more and more bizarre. Shortly before, the final straw was the weekend of the Long Beach Grand Prix. We used to go down there and take a motorhome down there every year, and we would park in the infield, and the men would go down on Thursday, and then the women were allowed to come down on Sunday for the race. But we had to go down and get it set up right, you know, and get ready for the race. And I'd been drunk, of course, for 3 days, and I was up on top of this motorhome, and it was a nice, hot summer day, and it was, you know, everybody had been drunk down there for a few days, and we'd made this sign, this little caricature of a woman's bust, and we were holding it up like this, and pretty soon, a couple of women across the way on this motorhome shot, and lifted up their tops like that, you know, and we're up there cheering and yelling and screaming, and pretty soon we look over, and on top of the motorhome, they made this little caricature of the opposite, and of course, you know, who had his pants down around his ankles right away. And, you know, that was pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. She said, that's the last straw. You've embarrassed me for the last time. And I had a great affinity for running around without my clothes on when I drank, and I don't know why. You know, maybe you guys said, but we don't know a new freedom. And so I guess I knew a new freedom because I sure as hell really ran around my clothes on a lot when I was drinking. And God, I played a lot of softball during this first marriage. I played on a lot of baseball and softball teams and stayed pretty active. And one night we'd won a softball championship. And, you know, the proverbial thing to do is go to the pizza joint and get a couple pitchers of beer. And, of course, most of the guys would go get a pitcher of beer, drink a couple glasses, and go out in the family. And we won the championship this one particular night. And my buddy and I were sitting there talking, and we decided that it would be the other team that we had just beat had showed up. It would be a really cool thing if we were to go out to the car and get naked and get our trophies and run through the pizza joint naked with our trophies, you know. The grandiose alcoholic thinking. And so we went out and we took our clothes off and got the trophies and ran through the pizza place. The only problem is while we were out getting out of our clothes, a girl's body stock softball team had walked into the pizza place. So there we are running around in front of these young girls. And you know, just disgusting stuff. Stuff like that to me is just disgusting. And yet that's where alcoholism took me. So she wanted me to leave the house, and so I moved out. And that same year, my father had been put in the hospital, and he had been diagnosed with a rare spinal disease, and he was put in a wheelchair, and I was angry. And I was ashamed, and I had a lot of fear, and I don't know what you do behind those kind of feelings, but I drink. You know, that's a good thing for somebody like me to do, is I drink when I feel that way, and it bothered me immensely, and thank God my dad got to see me sober before he passed on. My senior, my 18-year-old daughter was diagnosed with cancer, and they told us that she had a 50-50 chance to live 6 months. She had Hodgkin's disease, and at that time they were just starting to really find some cures for Hodgkin's disease, and I remember that today I put God on the shelf. I said, there'll never ever be a God that'll ever work in my life, because I can't believe that God would give an 18-year-old girl cancer. And then that's how I always had to have somebody to blame. You know, I always wanted to be a victim. I've always been a victim of what went on in my life. And I'm happy to announce that she's been in remission now for 13 years, and I've got a grandson, and that's only by God's grace that stuff happens. I also went to Mazatlan, Mexico that year. Man, 86 was a good year. I mean, a lot of stuff went on for me that year, and I met the lady that I'm married to today, who I'll share with you tomorrow afternoon. And while I was down there, I met her, and we agreed to write back and forth to each other. She lived in Denver, Colorado, and I was living down in Long Beach, and I had gotten back into the house just before that weekend one more time with my first wife. So I got back home, and I'd been there, and after being home for about 3 days, I didn't know anything about blood alcohol level or anything like that, and I had a grand mal seizure, and my children got to watch that, and I flopped around on the floor, and I chewed some holes in my tongue, and I got real sick, and they had to hospitalize me. They put me in the hospital, and while I was in the hospital, I was hooked up. I had phenobarbital going in one arm, and Dilantin going in the other arm, and the keen alcoholic mind went to work, and I thought, well, you know, if I'm taking anticonvulsants, I probably don't have to worry about having another seizure. So I called a friend of mine and had him bring me those little airplane bottles of whiskey down to the hospital, and then I just laid in the hospital and drank the whiskey, and it was a pretty good thing for 3 days. But they ran all these tests, and they got all done with these tests, and they said, Mr. Fox, we think the reason that you had that seizure is that while you were in Mexico, you had a large amount of shellfish, and you drank a large amount of alcohol, and that's a real deadly combination. The iodine in the shellfish mixed with the alcohol is a real no-no, Of course, I knew exactly what my problem was. Shellfish was my problem. It was probably going to kill me. I didn't eat it for 4 years. I'm still a little leery about it today, you know. But I continued to drink, and it just got worse, never better. Carmelita moved out in November. She came out from Denver. We had this long-term love, a long-distance love affair where we would run back and forth across the country. And she moved in, and we set out to tread through it, a happy destiny, and she became my best drinking buddy, and by this time we'd also discovered the joy of some other chemicals that allowed you to stay up longer and drink longer, and just that crazy, and it just got totally insane. And my business started to go down the tubes, and my health started to fail, and my behavior was starting to change. You know, I remember distinctly my father telling me one time, he says, Harold, you changed, you're not the same kid that I brought up, you know. And I thought, oh well, if you had my problems, you got to change too, you know. I just real sick behavior, and we finally got up to April of 1990, and Carmelita and I had just been through hell in a handbasket, and well, I'd been on a real hard 4-day run, and got up on Monday morning to go to work, and I got up on Monday morning. Let me back up here. I got to get honest. I didn't get up to go to work. I got up. I'd been passed out, and I got up, and she said something, which I thought was particularly rude, something to the effect of, aren't you going to go to work again today? And I did something that I'd never done in my whole life. I went into a rage, and I ran across the living room, and grabbed her by the neck, and I pushed her up against the kitchen sink, and I'm getting her back over the sink, and I put my thumbs in her larynx, and I told her, I'm going to kill you. And I had every intention of squashing the life out of her. That's where alcoholism took me. And I think God intervened that day, and I let her go, and then I spit in her face. Now, that's probably just about as disgusting a thing as I could ever think that anybody would ever do. And I'm not proud of that, but it's important for me to remember that. You know, it's important to remember that when I drink alcohol, that's where I end up. I've had a drink now in almost 8 years, but I guarantee you that I know that the disease is progressive. I've watched what happens. I don't know where I would be tonight if I picked up a drink, and I don't want to find out. She left me, thank God, and I set out to drink with a vengeance then when she left me. I thought, good, she's gone. This is what I was telling myself. This isn't how I really felt, but what I told myself was, good, she's gone. I have no responsibility to anybody now. I'll do whatever the hell I want whenever I get good and ready to do it. Well, the business was going down the tubes, and I had an office up above a two-story tent-up building and had a steel three-hour fire door with a nine-inch glass window in it. I moved up there. I took a couch up there. I took newspaper and put it over the nine-inch glass window so nobody could peek in. And I sat up there and drank with a vengeance, with an absolute vengeance, and I hated everybody's guts. My tools for living when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous were anger, fear, guilt, self-pity. And I love self-pity. It's so sincere. I just delight in self-pity. And I sat up there and I drank, and I moved out of the apartment. I moved home with Mom, but I was never there. My dad was still alive at that time, and I just started to drink, and I felt so sorry for myself, and I thought, what has my life become that I could not drink? We talked about this, a gentleman that's going to speak for you tomorrow night, and I was talking about this. You know, I wonder how many alcoholics die when they're not drinking, because I can't not drink. When I don't drink alcohol, I can't stand the way I feel. And, you know, I wonder how many of us die because we don't have a program that's been given to us. You know, it's devastating to think about it. And I could not drink, and so I'm sitting up there drinking, and I can't really get drunk, and I can't really get sober. I really don't want to get sober, don't know anything about it. I don't know, and maybe I'm still in denial tonight, but I don't think I've ever heard of the word Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I can remember. And I sat up there and drank, and it got to be the 25th of May, and it wasn't any different than any other night. I ran out of booze, and I ran out of dope, and I knew that I needed some more, and I wasn't going home. I'd already made that decision that I was just going to sit up there, and it was a Thursday night, and I knew that I wasn't going to have to open the office the next day, and I was just going to sit up there and just get drunk. And I went into the bathroom, splashed some water in my face, and brushed my hair, because I'm one of the people, even if the inside is absolutely dying, I got to look good on the outside, you know, and I weighed about 50 pounds less than I do now, and my face was sucked in, and I was about the color of Mary Helen's sweatshirt, and it was terrible. And I looked in the mirror, and I think I had the most important meeting I'll ever have, and I had to have that meeting with Harold in the mirror, and I looked, and I thought, my God, what have I become? And I didn't have the drink that night. I went back home to Mom's, you know, got to go back home to Mom's, and I remember sitting down on the couch, and she looked at me, and she just said, you know, I don't know why I wasn't an alcoholic there, that said the magic words to me, and my mom's hell, she's still a pre-Al-Anon. She needs Al-Anon bad, you know, but she said those magic words. She says, do you want help? And I said, yes. And I started bawling, and they said, well, maybe you can get in one of these recovery centers, you know. So I get on the phone, and I start making these phone calls. I remember calling a hospital down in Newport Beach, and they said, yeah, we got a bed for you. Come on down here, man. 30 days, $30,000. Just bring us a check. And I was pretty indignant. I said, if I had $30,000, I wouldn't need your damn help. And I called around and called around, and I found a place down in the desert where we live now, and we went down there. It's not any different than anywhere else, I guess. They just do the alcoholic drill there, and I went down there, and I went in there, and I was so grateful today that the people that worked at this place were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. None of them tried to tell me that I had bipolar disorder. And none of them tried to tell me that I came from a dysfunctional family. None of them told me that I was hypoglycemic, because I would have used all that stuff. I would have used all that stuff. And nobody, you know, they didn't tell me that I was diabetic, which I may have been. I don't know. What they told me is I had a disease called alcoholism, and they handed me a blue book. And they said, if you will read this blue book and you will follow the directions that are in that book, you can change your life around. One or two things will happen if you read this book. You're either going to die, and if you don't read this book, they said you're either going to die an alcoholic death, or you'll read this book and learn how to live a spiritual way of life. And what my response to that was, do you have any other choices? because neither one of them really sounded attractive to me. I really didn't want to die, and I really wasn't too much into living the spiritual life. I told you, you know, I was still angry at God because of what he'd done to my daughter, even though she was in remission. And I went to church when I was younger. I was the only member of our family that went to church. To this day, I don't know why. My brother didn't go, my mom and dad didn't go, but I was sent to church, and I was scared of God. You know, fear is an overwhelming thing. That's the prime motivator of all my character defects. I was scared to death of God. And I got this book, and I started to read this book, and I told you earlier I didn't understand about having alcoholism, and they said, well, you need to know that you're powerless over alcohol. And I said, what do you mean I am powerless? I'm not powerless over nothing. They said, when you take the first drink, it sets off something in your body that makes you take another drink. And they said, the first drink gets you drunk. And I said, nah, that first drink don't get me drunk. Hell, I never got drunk on one drink. And, of course, they, you know what they said, well, when's the last time you only had one drink? Bingo. You know, and I had to think back about that. I never stopped to have one drink. I can't tell you how many times that I've had what I would consider a rough day at work. I would get in the car, maybe I got whistled a bit, I got on the freeway a little bit late, and the freeway would be jammed up in L.A., down in your area, Jack, down by Hughes, you know, and I'd leave there, and I'd think, well, I already made this decision. I wasn't going to drink today, you know. But there's a lot of traffic, and maybe I just will stop and have two. So I'd get off there at Rosecrans, right there at the off-ramp liquor store, and go into that little bar right across the street. Just going to have two. And the next thing I know, it's just right out of Bill's store, you know, and right out of Chapter 3. It'd be 10 o'clock at night, and I'd be sitting there thinking, how'd I get here again? I've had 8 or 9 drinks. I'm already in trouble now. It's too late to call home. I might as well just stay. And I'd stay, and then I'd get back in the freeway. I am so grateful that I never got in a car accident and killed anybody. Because I drove drunk thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And never, ever, you know, I know tonight that God was with me then, just like he is tonight. And I never, ever thought I would ever acknowledge that, you know. And so I was actually able to take the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous and identify what my problem was, is that I had a disease called alcoholism, but I had to learn it. You know, I hear a lot of folks come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they think the most misquoted line in our book is where they say, we had to concede your animal self, we were alcoholics, this is the first step in recovery. And that's not what it says, it says we learned that we had to fully concede. And I had to learn what alcoholism was. I had to learn about a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And the old timers made it so simple for me. They said, if you clear up the spiritual malady, the mental obsession will go away. And if the mental obsession goes away, you'll never ever have to pick up another drink one day at a time to trigger that physical allergy. That made sense to me, and that's real simple. And if I can keep it that simple, I'm in good shape. And they told me I needed to find a God here. I needed to find a power greater myself. And I didn't think I was insane. And they said, hell, the insanity for you isn't running around with your clothes off. Alcohol was running the show then. The insanity for people like you is the thinking that precedes picking up that first drink, that this time it's going to be different. And it never got different. Never got different. It got worse. But it damn sure never got better. And so, you know, I don't know exactly how I came to believe. I guess I believe because I knew you guys believed. I believe because I knew you believed. There were people that came here before me that were living good, productive lives, and I heard you talk about it in meetings, and I heard you tell me, I have a God that works in my life today, you know? And I think the book talks about it. It says, you know, what have I got to lose? Either God's everything or God is nothing. So I made this decision, and I got down on my knees, and I took this little third-step prayer, and I got back on the couch, and nothing changed. So I thought something was going to happen right there. You know, I've taken the third step, and my life hasn't changed a bit. And the old-timers, they kind of tricked me. They said, well, you haven't taken the action yet. You really take step 3 is to take steps 4 through 9. And I set out to write this inventory, and God, I had a lot of resentments. And I never knew I resented people. And I hated my brother's guts. My brother had been my partner in my business, and it was the business that we were in together, and I bought him out, and he had become very, very successful in doing the same kind of business that I did, and it was his business in direct competition to me. And about 3 weeks before I got sober, the last guy left on the planet that would still drink with me, and he and I had got together. We were drinking up at the office, and Usually I was just planning where I was going to burn down my brother's business now. I was going to become an arsonist. But I also wanted to burn down his house. But I didn't want his wife and kids to be in there because I thought they were kind of like okay. And then I decided that it would look so much more impressive if both of them were to go up simultaneously. And I went through the teen alcoholic thinking, and of course, thank God we just continued to get drunk and nothing ever happened. Now, as a result of taking the inventory and realizing that my part in all this stuff was, my brother's my employer today. I lost my business. He's still very successful. I work for him. He pays me a real good wage. I give him a real good day's work. You know, that's... I found a design for living in Alcoholics Anonymous, the book says, and it really works. It really, really works. I had a lot of resentments at Carmelita, you know, and I had a lot of resentments at my first wife, and I resented my kids, and I resented God, and I resented the state of California. I had a lot of resentment, and I had a lot of fear, and not the kind of fear where somebody would come up and put a gun to my head. I had the kind of fear I have is that you guys are going to find out who I really am and what I've really done to you and what are you going to do back to me. That kind of fear. The fear of losing something I've already got. And I hurt a lot of people. You know, I just hurt a lot of people, not necessarily physically, but by my actions or the lack of those same actions. And I went and I shared this thing. Now, the funny deal is when I shared this inventory, I didn't trust anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a H&I panel that came in, and I met some of the people, and I remember talking to them, and so I chose to share this thing with an Episcopalian minister, and I shared it with him, and I thought, boy, that's over, I'm glad I'll never ever have to see him again, you know. And of course I did the thing which was in style, as I went, if you're new here tonight, please hear this, if you write a first step and you share it, don't go tear it up, because you're going to need a little later on. But I tore it up and burned it and did that deal, and there was a true series of coincigods, I guess. Carmelita and I got back together, and we moved down to Palm Springs and found this place to live. She said we were going to go meet the landlord at 6 o'clock that evening, and we got over there to meet him. And here come walking down the sidewalk to be our landlord was that Episcopal minister that I shared that fist up with. I know that God has a great sense of humor. And you know, if you'd have told this man what I told this man, you wouldn't have rented an apartment to me. He not only rented the apartment to us, we didn't have to give him a security deposit, and we didn't have to give him last month's rent. And it wasn't until a couple of years after that I found out that he was also 19 or 20 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had more things go on in my life since I got sober that I see happen like that. I'm just totally amazed. And I had to deal with these things called character defects. And somebody told me, you're not going to get rid of character defects. God's going to take care of those, and he's going to remove those as he sees fit, because you don't know enough to know what your own character defects are. You might have identified them, but don't mean nothing, because they may become your greatest assets. And I found out that, you know, through the process of sponsoring other men, a lot of the stuff that I have done and a lot of the ways that I have felt and a lot of the defects of character I have have become very, very valuable tools and very valuable information to share with another alcoholic, to understand how they feel. I think God gives us something that nobody else has. And that's the ability that somebody walks in that's new and walks into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and sits down and starts to tell us their story. And we can say something that a religious man could never say, or a psychiatric man, or a medical doctor. The two words, I understand. I understand how you feel, you know, and that's been a very, very, very valuable thing for me to do. So I told you I burnt this first step, so I had to make this list, but I knew who I'd hurt. I knew exactly who I'd hurt and what I had to do, and I started to clear up some of this wreckage of my past, and through the process of doing that, you know, I'm a free man this evening. I don't have to look in the rearview mirror when I drive around. I don't have to peek through the blinds. I can sit out here in this park this afternoon and know that, you know, I paid my dues. I paid my dues. And I feel real, real good about that. I owe the state of California a lot of money. I told you that I was a contractor in there. The last couple of years while I was contracting, I was taking money out of my employees' checks for workman's comp and state disability and all that, but I never quite saw the necessity of mailing it in. So I owed the state of California $23,000. And I remember they called and said, you need to clear this up. And I went down to my sponsor and I said, Jim, how am I going to do this? I own $23,000. So now I'm going to pay this back, you know, in one lump sum, because grandiosity is my form of life. So I want to go down and take the whole $23,000, throw it on the desk and say, here's your money, you know. And I said, how am I going to do this? And he said, well, you're going to pay him back, and you're going to pay him back one paycheck at a time. What a concept. One paycheck at a time, one day at a time, $1 at a time. And it took us, I don't know, three and a half years, and they paid in full. I have a current driver's license today, and current insurance, and current registration, all at the same time. Imagine that. Now, that's not anything that I would have ever thought. I mean, I had one out of three, two out of three, but never all at the same time. You know, when I get the opportunity to take a look each day at my actions and the way that I, and, you know, my wife and I got sober together. She came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She came for this family week that they had at this institution I was in, and to learn how to deal with me because I was her problem. And she was over there for a while, and then they said, you know, honey, we love having you here. We think you belong in the other room with him. And so she got sober, and if you're new here and you're in a relationship, God bless you. I'm telling you, we probably came closer to killing each other sober than we ever did drunk. It's a real difficult thing, because for years, the way I dealt with things was just to drink. You know, it's like that old proverbial, there's an elephant running around in the living room, but let's pretend it's not really there, you know? And we got sober together, and we're still in a pretty healthy relationship, and I think it's a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think a lot of it has to do with the traditions that we've had this evening. Nobody's in charge in our house. It's a good thing I'm not in charge. You know, things would be a lot different, by God. No, we just, we got sober together, and we've gotten involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and found a God that worked in my life. We recently just started going back to church, and there's a thing that I never thought I would do. And I love going now, and I love what they do there, and I feel like I've been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where I go. I don't, you know what, now maybe this is just my perception, you know, there's a guy in West LA that talks about alcoholism being a disease of perception. But what I perceive that goes on while I go to church is that I'm not getting preached at. Our pastor shares his experience, strength, and hope with us. That's what he does, and it's a wonderful thing. We just love going. Step 12 is something that I think has saved my life, has absolutely saved my life. God has put men in my life at just exactly the right time. I'm absolutely convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that God knows what he's doing, but because they're all gone. My friend Perry came down here with me as a fine example. God's just been awful good to me. He's been awful good to me, and he puts people in my life, and things go on in their life, and just when I'm struggling with a certain area, and I think things are really, really tough, and then God will put this newcomer on my life, and I get to sit down with him like the people sat down with me and read the book. God, I got to tell my story about Nancy, too. Nancy's my wife's sponsor, and when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got involved heavily, and I got involved real quick, and I started doing this stuff real quick. I needed to do this. And Carmelita got sober also, but she just wasn't doing Alcoholics Anonymous right. And I was on her quite a bit. I just didn't think she was doing the thing right. And one night the telephone rings, and I guess I'm, I don't know, 9 months sober, a year sober, and Carmelita answers, and she goes, here, it's a Nancy. She wants to talk to you. Now, what my head told me was, by God, I got what my life sponsor wants. I spiritually fit. And she gets on the phone, and Nancy's from New Orleans, and still, she can, I think maybe she just does it when she's trying to be cute, but she has the greatest old Southern accent, and she says, Harold, honey? And I go, yeah, and she goes, I need to tell you something. I go, what's that? And she goes, it's none of your business what step your life's on, and it's none of your business when she last called me, and it's really none of your business when she last went to a meeting. Got it? Click. And I was livid. The nerve of this woman to do this to me. And so I called my sponsor right away, of course, because I've been taught to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that when I have a resentment, I may have to drink. So I called my sponsor, and I ran this tale away by him, and she listens, you know, and there's a little pause, and then he says, well, you know, it really isn't any of your damn business what step she's on when she last went to me or when she last talked to her sponsor. Correct. You know, and so I learned that really her program is really none of my business. You know? My program, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is my business, and that's, you know, life has went on. There's been a lot of struggle. There's been a lot of joy. There's been an awful lot of joy. I'm sure that these seemingly bad things that have happened have always happened for a purpose. And every time that these bad things seem to happen, it seems like that my life has changed. There's been I've reached another plateau. I've had the opportunity to walk through something that I'll be able to use. When we were 35 days sober, 35, 40, 50 days sober, I don't remember now. We were back up in Long Beach, and of course I've been told to change my playgrounds and my playmates and my playthings. So of course I go back to my one guy that I used to race boats with. He still was drinking like a fish. And he used to ask me, would you mind stopping to get a six pack of beer for me? I know you don't drink, but you won't mind getting it for me on the way home. And I said, oh no, John, I wouldn't mind. Nah. And I'd stop at 7-Eleven. I'd sweat bullets with a six pack of beer because I'm afraid one of you guys is going to see me walking out of the register with a six pack of beer, and I'd take it home to him. Well, Connelly and I had been to a meeting at an MWA club in Long Beach that night, and we came home, and the neighbor came running out, and they said, there's been a real serious thing happened. You need to find John. His son-in-law has been murdered in a drug deal. And what had happened, that they put a gun up against him and pulled the trigger and blew his heart out of his back. And they knew who John was. See, John he was out at the 2020 Club on Broadway in Long Beach, and I knew where he was. And I went down there, and I had to walk into that bar, and I took God with me. I'm sure I took God with me. I don't remember inviting him, but I'm sure I took him with me. And I went in and got John off that bar stool, and we went down, and we were able to bury his son, and that was a painful thing to have to go through. And we moved down to the desert, and I told you about the moving down there, and when we were about 90 days sober, and that Episcopalian minister being our first landlord, well, we couldn't live there. My wife has real bad allergies, and we found out there was a bunch of dogs that lived there, and she damn near died in that apartment. So we moved out of there and moved over to another little home, and we'd been there, I don't know, about 3 or 4 days, and I was in bed, and she was she's very, very creative, and she was sewing curtains and stuff and putting those up in the front room, and I hear this terrible crash, and I was sure that somebody would come back after me, you know, as a result of something I'd done in the past. And what had happened was a drunk driver had came across the front lawn in a 2.5-ton flatbed and missed her. She was in the front window by about 6 or 7 feet, and he went through the bedroom wall and through the closet and out through the other wall and down into the community swimming pool in this truck. And of course, every public agency in the world showed up. And if you're a guy like me that used to peek out of the blinds a lot and a truck drives through your house, it's kind of like on duty, you know. And I didn't have to drink that night. And all these uniformed people showed up. And incredible stuff goes on, you know. And I keep thinking, I used to say, well, why me? And they'd go, well, why not you? You know, I mean, you're no different than anybody else around here. And I was probably 2.5 years sober, and I'd been invited back to share at this treatment center where I'd gotten sober. And I went for coffee afterwards, and I got a phone call, and a lady down at Desert Hospital that called and said, you know, I just lost a patient. She's 30 years old. She died of a brain tumor, and her husband's here. He's 4 years sober, and he wants to go drink. Would you come down and talk to him? I said, well, sure. Absolutely. I'll always go. I'll never turn down a request from Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm afraid to turn it down. And so I went down there to talk to him, and I'm sure God sent me down there for a purpose that night, because I sat and we talked. We decided that drinking probably wasn't a great thing for people like us to do, and we talked it all the way through. And I got home, and after I got home, my telephone rang, and it was my mother, and said my father had a massive heart attack, and I'm so grateful that I was married to a lady that was in the program, because I didn't know what to do. I said, well, what do you think I ought to do? She goes, I think we need to get our butts in the truck and get to Long Beach. And we drove up there, and he was dead on arrival. And, you know, I buried my father, and I don't know about you, I don't do funerals well, I don't do weddings well, I don't do Timothy's well, you know, I don't do life very well. And, you know, I found out that I can put one foot in front of the other and just go do this stuff. And a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up, and he brought a 12-and-12 with him up to Rose Hills. And you know what I did was I used that 12. I had my own with me, but I was surprised because he showed up with one. And What I did is I put my two-year chip in my father's casket and I read the 11-step prayer as part of the eulogy. People at Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that. I don't know how to do that kind of stuff. I guess I've been blessed or I've been saddened, I don't know, but I've been to a lot of AA memorial services. I was at one that Jack kind of officiated at when we had to bury a guy named Johnny W., who was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned about having these memorials. I like AA memorial services. They're uplifting to me because we don't go there and it's not a sad kind of thing. And, it'll be 3 years ago this August. Life was good, and life was really good, and I had this job, and we had a place to live, and we'd made most of our amends, and we've been very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, been involved in a lot of conferences, and hospitals and institutions work, and intergroup, and central office, and just done what we were asked, and I just thought, you know, I just can't get any better than this, and I get a page run after it. Early one morning, and it was my wife, and she was hysterical, and our 2.5-year-old grandson had been hit by a car and killed right behind her house. And my world stopped right then. Right then and there, my world stopped. It was like a nuclear holocaust hit, and because 2.5-year-old kids, you know, I expect to bury my mom, and my dad expect to bury my grandparents. Don't expect to bury my kids, and damn sure don't expect to bury my grandchild. Didn't pick up a drink. I did not have to pick up a drink, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened was another one of those coincidences. I'm not nearly important enough to have a cell phone, but that day I had one. My brother was on vacation, and he had given me his, and I got in the car, and I'm going to be by myself now, from Moreno Valley to the desert. It's a 45-minute drive, and I'm going to have to process all this through this. What's going on? My grandson's dead. I don't know what that means. That doesn't compute. That's totally incomprehensible to me. But I did what you guys taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took the phone and I called my sponsor. And I said, Jim, I think my grandson's dead. And he says, what do you want me to do? And I said, I want you to call Nancy. I want you to call Carmelita's sponsor. I said, she works at Eisenhower Medical Center. There's only, I don't know, 4,000 people that work there, but she works over there. And she beat me to the house. You know, she beat me to the house. And what happened was Alcoholics Anonymous came to our house. You guys came and you sat with us and you held us. You cried with us. You laughed with us. You shared with us. And we didn't have to pick up a drink. We had an AA memorial service for our grandson. I don't know how that worked out. I'll tell you how bizarre it got, and I don't want this to sound funny, to me it's funny. We're the only people I know that have went to a mortuary and they let us have a potluck at the mortuary, you know? Because we didn't have any money, our kids didn't have any money. But that's what I've been taught in AA is we go to a meeting, we bring some food, you know, and we share. So we went there, and what happened was all the people that knew Joshua, our grandson, because he was a sober, he was sober as a matter of fact, but he brought up an Alcoholics Anonymous because our kids and stuff had went to meetings with us. And so people came, and they bought potluck, and, the mortuary discounted the deal, and as people walked out, they handed me envelopes, and I was putting envelopes, and one guy I know didn't have two nickels rubbed together, handed me $5, put it in my coat pocket, and we didn't know how this was going to be paid for, and God takes care of us, kids. God takes care of us, you know, at the end of this tale, we were given just exactly enough money to get that thing handled. Not a penny more, not a penny less, it's just, God is so awesome. My God is so awesome. You know, all I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was just to be loved. I think that's all any of us has ever wanted, is just to be loved. And I found the incredible, incredible love in these rooms. I've had a great journey so far in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Irish, and I always wanted to go to Ireland. But a drunk like me ain't ever going to go to Ireland. And got a call one day, and people said, we're putting together this thing, and we're going to go to Ireland. And they told us what the price was, and we started adding it all up, and maybe we could do this thing. maybe we could do this. And we flew to Ireland year before last for the 50th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous there. I met my friend John, who's married to my wife's sponsor through Christian Kisses, I guess, and that's a kind of an inside thing that we're not going to that. But we went to Ireland and we went with 40 alcoholics and 4 Al-Anons, and nobody could punch anybody. We were like all stuck in a bus for 11 days, 10 or 11 days. Went in 10 or 11 days, went all over the place, and ended up in Kearney, Grand Eagles Hotel. 4 days, 5,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Common problem, common solution, unconditional love. It doesn't matter where I've been in the world. I've been all over the country. I've been on the East Coast. That's not entirely true, but I've been to a lot of places. I just recently got back from Atlanta. I went back to visit my daughter and went to a meeting in Jonesboro and started with Serenity Prayer, read a little bit, people shared, said Lord's Prayer, went home, felt great. You know, and that's the neat thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, no matter where I go, it's just a great feeling of. It's an honor to be here tonight. I need to tell you that. It's an honor. You know, people, my mom always said, like, I go to Skid Row. And she goes, well, why did you go to Skid Row? And I said, because it's an honor to go to Skid Row. It's an honor to get invited to go anywhere. And nobody would invite me any place. And I get to go and do it, see and experience things today. And I got to be on the service committee. I need to shut up. But man, I just, there's not enough words to describe. I got to go and do a service for the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego. Got the little vest and the little yellow visor thing. It was so cool and I was so proud of it. I'm like a little kid, man. I'm going to be 8 years old, so it's like, I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. I went directly from puberty to midlife crisis, for Pete's sakes, you know. I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. But they said, go do this. And I said, okay, I'll go do this. And I'll tell you this, and then I'm going to shut up, because this is an overwhelming thing for me. My life sponsor, this time, got sober at the International Convention in New Orleans in 1980. And she walked in, and I think Lois Wilson was speaking. And so we started talking about being a service for this International Convention. She goes, you got to go to the International Convention and see the flag ceremony. She goes, I got sober at that. And she goes, it's awesome. And I said, okay, let's go do it. So we drove down, we did all the meetings, got a little vest, got a little hat, and I got to be an usher, and I got to stand there. Well, I was inside the stadium, the Jack Murphy Stadium, and those of you that were there know there was 50 or 55,000 of us or something incredible, and we filled the stadium up the opening night, but I was inside the stadium while all you guys were outside the stadium. It was like the Roma Gladiator thing, man. They're going to open up the doors and people come charging in. And the aisle that I had was the dog and the lift group. They all came down there to sit together, Jack. And they all come through there and all these smiles and everything. And I'm shaking hands with these people, man. And I'm just like, there ain't no combination of alcohol drugs that ever make me feel the way I felt that night. And I go and I sit down there and I was sitting between my wife and her sponsor. And they go, fuck, how did it feel look like to that place? And we got to hold hands, and I got to experience what Nancy experienced. And I'm telling you, it was, I hate to get emotional, but hell, I could cry at a supermarket opening now, you know, it's just like, it's just, I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really love you people. You've taught me how to live. You've taught me how to be a productive member of society again. I'm going to close with this. I had a little thing printed on a card, and there's a friend of mine that's from the Preston Group down in Dallas, Texas. His name's John A., and John shared this, and I was so enthralled with it, I put it on a card, and I put my phone number on it, and if any of you wanted to, I think I've got some with me in the van, I'll give it to you, but John says, there is the love of a husband for his wife, and there is the love of a child for his mother, but there is no love like the love of one alcoholic sharing with another. And God bless you, and I love you all, and hey, let's have a great weekend. Thank you.